Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? It's a pleasure to be here tonight. Congratulations on another successful convention out here, and a real special congratulations to those of you that stood up tonight with 30 days and under. That's the highlight of the meeting, and we're downhill from there. As far as I'm concerned, that's just wonderful to see people that are just walking in here and enable us that have been around a while to think back on how significant it was that somehow we were chosen to get in here. You know, we go from the hells of alcoholism into this unknown thing as Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have no appreciation in the beginning of what a tremendous event has just taken place, that we're being moved from this painful prison of self-centeredness into this exhilarating climb into spirituality, and we have no idea that is what is happening. And in retrospect, I can look back and see that the person who came into my life and grabbed me out of the hellhole of alcoholism was really a very important rescuer in my life. And it's almost like a messenger from God came into my life. But when you're new, you don't see it that way. It's hard to, for instance, if you're new and you got here because some cop pulled you over for drunk driving, it's real hard under those circumstances to see that cop as a messenger from God. You know what I'm saying? It's just, we sort of sit there and go, what's he picking on me for? There's a lot of other drunk drivers out there tonight, and all the bad luck that I got selected to come in here. And I suppose that's the beginning of seeing all the wonderful paradoxes of sobriety and seeing that having to surrender is how we win, and seeing that giving up enables us to have everything, and all the wonderful things that happen in sobriety. And so I take my hat off to those of you that are new in your first month, and I just wish you the absolute best, that you stick around, stay in the middle of all these people. If you stay in the middle of AA, you can't slip off the edge. You know what I mean? Just stay here. You become part of something, and this whole AA succeeds, and you succeed along with it. And everybody will have you in our prayers, and it's very exciting to be with you. Now, it's traditional, giving an AA talk to tell a little bit about how it was and how we got here and so on down. And I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, had a very nice upbringing, nice family, and my parents worked very hard and sent my sister and I to good schools, and I went to the local university in New Haven, and went on, joined the Marine Corps, and was a fighter pilot there for 13 years, got married, had six children, and if you were to look at, you know, my resume, or whatever you want to call that, which is very misleading as to whether who we are, but that's what we use, you would have said, well, gee, you know, this guy is coming along all right. A lot of typical alcoholic story, if you know what I mean. The external looks pretty good, and the guy's about to have a convulsion and go into a nut ward, you know, But on the outside, it looked like it was going along fairly well. But that's not where our story is. Our story has nothing to do with the outside. Our stories that we share and the reason that we connect with one another is what was going on the inside, because that's where we're all so similar, and that's the part that we were so afraid that other people were going to find out about. That's what I kept a secret. I didn't want anyone to know how frightened I was. I didn't want anyone to know that I knew that my whole world was collapsing. I was trying to pretend that none of that was happening. I think one of the greatest strenuous, painful part of being an alcoholic is to pretend that you're not an alcoholic and that none of this is happening and you're not in pain and everything is fine. You just puked up blood and you walk out and they go, how you doing, Mary? I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. Because if we weren't fine, then someone might come into our lives and want to zero in on the drinking and suggest, maybe, that we ought to stop drinking. And, of course, that was impossible. And so there was this requirement to just put up this tremendous front that everything was all right. And so I'm one of those who just went and tried to convince the outside world and myself, I suppose, that everything was all right. Alcohol for me was a tremendous power. When I look back on it, that's what alcohol was. Very powerful. It had the power to change the world that I lived in from an uncomfortable, threatening place to a comfortable place where I liked everybody in it. And I had heard about this world before I started drinking. Other people used to come up to me, even when I was 18, 19 years old, and they'd say, "Isn't this world wonderful?" And I would go, "What world are they looking at? I mean, we're both standing within a foot of each other, and one person is saying, 'Isn't this world wonderful?' And I'm looking around to see if they're looking at the same world I'm looking at, because it was not wonderful. From where I was sitting, the world was quite intimidating. I didn't seem to fit in anywhere. I never experienced closeness with anybody. I always sort of stayed off by myself inside. I didn't really trust anybody, and I was very fearful. I went to a church, and they told me about this loving God, but I never experienced it. I began to think that maybe I was on God's list, that there were a few of us in the world that he didn't like, and I was one of them, because all these things other people were talking about, this brotherly love and this wonderful relationship you can have with a higher power and how you can have serenity and all these things, never did I have a glimpse of that. One night when I was 19 years old, and I was a freshman in this university, and we were gathered together to do something that I dread, which was meet other people. Just go in that room and go meet those 30 guys and sort of socialize. That was like telling me to go into a snake pit. I mean, this was just so intimidating to walk in and try to walk up to a group of people, and you knew they didn't want you there. You could see it in their eyes. They just looked over, and I would start around the room, and as I approached a group of people, I could see in their eyes, "No, not this group. You go over there with those guys." And I'd go over there, and they'd signal me to go over there. Pretty soon I'd made the rounds of the room, and no group wanted me. I could see that in their eyes, and so I'd go over in the corner and figure out how I could get out of there. That's sort of how the social skills that I had at that point in time. And on that evening, I decided to have a drink. My roommates had talked to me, and they said, "Geez, you're 19, you haven't had a drink. Everybody's drinking here, you know." And I said, "Well, I want to be an athlete. I'm trying to get good grades and et cetera, et cetera." But this night, they told me, they said, "This stuff is wonderful. It'll make you feel good. You'll enjoy it." So I thought that night, under what I felt was a tremendous amount of pressure, that I was in with all these mean people, that I would have a drink. So I went over to the bar and I ordered some whiskey and soda or something like that and drank it right down, tasted terrible. And I waited for this wonderful sensation that was going to take place, and nothing happened. So I immediately got another one, went back to the bartenders and, "Let me have another one of those things." And I poured that one down. I just sort of stood there waiting for this transformation, and nothing was happening, so I got another one. And I was sort of halfway through that third drink, wondering when all this action took place, when I looked back at the room that I was in, and nothing had happened to me. I was still just felt exactly the same. But while I was screwing around with that whiskey, the 30 mean guys had left, and they were replaced by 30 of the friendliest people I have ever seen in my life, all of the people in that room were looking at me going, "Hi, hi, please come over and talk to me." You know, just, "We want you in our group." And I was just, it was just wonderful. I mean, it was just marvelous. These people just cared so deeply about me, and I hadn't even met them yet. But I could see that in their eyes. They were just so friendly. So that was one change. And then the other change was how I felt about myself. And I remember just going, "Well, you'll just have to wait your turn. I will..." "I will be bestowing myself on you in turn, and let's see who the lucky group is going to be that gets me." So there was this whole new Alice in Wonderland quality to drinking. It transported me to the world I had heard about. Now I was experiencing brotherly love. Now I was experiencing a wonderful world. I would turn and say to people, "Isn't this world wonderful?" I used to say that in bars all the time. You know, it's three or four drinks, and I just turn to the guy next to me and go, "Isn't this world wonderful?" I mean, just, I remember going into a strange town and having a few drinks, and the bartender come over, and I'm sobbing. And he says, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I've just been overcome by the magnificence of your customers. I've just never seen people of this quality before. And it's just wonderful." So look what alcohol could do. It took me into a world that was a pleasure to be in. And when alcohol wore off, I went back to the old world. And so when people say that our problem is alcohol, I beg to differ. I don't remember that as being my problem at all. Now, maybe you're different than I was, but I'll tell you what my problem was back in those days. My problem was sobriety. That's what my problem was. I kept getting sober again. Time after time after time. And while I never said these words, I could have been saying them when I walked into a bar and the bartender came over and said, "Yes." I really was saying, "Do you have anything back there for sobriety? You got something that can fix a case of sobriety that I seem to have? I would like to quickly get unsober." And that's what alcohol was for, was to transport me away from this painful existence called sobriety, where I just sat there and there was just me. And that's what it was. There was just me. I was trying, because of the ideas that I had assembled in my head, and each one of us, I think, puts together, whether we know it or not, some sort of a game plan for living. You can call it your own philosophy, you can call it your outlook on life, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but each one of us ends up with some sort of a little package deal that we use to get through life. And mine was, as our big book describes, the philosophy of self-sufficiency. That a real man gets through life on his own resources. That was one of the core beliefs that I had, was that people who need people. You know that song, "People Who Need People, Lucky People"? No, that's a wrong song. That's not a song at all. I would hear that song and I'd go, "People who need people are weak." That's the way I felt about it. Now, this song wasn't out, but if it had been out back when I was drinking, it would have been my theme song. It was a song called "I Did It My Way." You know that song? Now we're talking more or less the philosophy that I have. There's sort of this wonderful adventurer who finds himself in jail and his life is all screwed up and he throws up every morning and But he did it his way. In other words, he got there totally on his own. And he never wimped out and never caved in on his convictions. He just stayed doing stupid things no matter what. And that is something that I felt the world admired. Did you ever have that feeling that here you clawed your way to the bottom and experiencing tremendous setbacks and pain, and you never wimped out, you never screamed or surrendered, you just went down all the way to the gutter without whimpering once? And in your mind, in your ego, you had a feeling that they would maybe do a movie about your life story. It's just, you know, there's just a lot of potential here for a story. I mean, this, we're talking about an epic journey to the gutter, with no wimping, and you sort of picture it would be sort of Billy the Kid or something like that, and they do a movie, and it's called What an Ass. That's the name of the movie. Because this whole perspective and philosophy of life is not complicated, and we don't need lots of psychiatrists and so on down, because Bill writes about us all throughout our literature, and he has a word that appears many, many times to describe this whole process. And the word is stupid. Stupid. You go look for that. You know, he'll be talking about something. He'll say, we're especially stupid in this area. And that's basically what it was. It was very stupid to cling and defend ideas that were getting terrible results. But that's what I was doing, because these weren't just ideas. These were convictions. And you just hold on to them and take them to the grave. You know what I mean? This is what reality is all about. And turns out that's not what reality is all about, but that's what stupidity is all about. That's exactly what that is. So I'm giving you a flavor of the way I saw things, that I had to rely on self-sufficiency, and it's me against the world. Now, to jump ahead, because I want to remember to make that connection, especially for those of you that are new, because I know a lot of you have glommed on to this philosophy of self-sufficiency. It is a very destructive process, because I remember one of the most debilitating parts of my alcoholism, when I would contemplate suicide and get in all those depressions where you sit on your bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're just weighing all the things you've done and thought and so on down. And one of the things that used to just drive me crazy was that I could not live up to any values that I had. I would set certain standards, and I'd say, this is what a father ought to be. And later on, I became a Marine pilot. And these are the standards that a pilot ought to have. And I had these moral values. I think all of us are especially sensitive people, and we have these values, and they're there, but we can never live up to them. And it used to trouble me deeply, and I came up with the idea that I must just be a bad person. And I know a lot of us alcoholics come in here with the sense that we're bad people because we're never able to live up to our values. And let me tell you what I think about that today. You're not supposed to be able to live up to your values on your own. You're not supposed to be able to be morally self-sufficient. Being morally self-sufficient would mean that you have the power to be your own higher power. And that's what I was trying to do. Didn't know that, but I was trying to be spiritual without a higher power. Other people may need a higher power to be spiritual, but some of us should be able to live up to higher standards and so on down, totally on our own. And again, that was a tremendous misunderstanding of how spiritual laws work and cause me a great deal of problems. And if there are new people, maybe you're into that same dilemma of feeling really bad about yourself, thinking that you were some sort of a moral degenerate when the total problem was you were stupid. So... maybe that'll partially get you off the hook. And in any event, my drinking led me, as I indicated, into the Marine Corps, where I became a fighter pilot, and I've got a lot of wonderful stories. I flew for them for about 12 years. Thank God I wasn't defending anything. I thought I did well to not crash a plane, to tell you the truth. But it was a lot of fun, and I did have a lot of interesting experiences. But there was a lot of drinking. I ran into a guy who was over in Japan with me back in the 50s, and God, we talked about how much drinking went on. It was just astounding. And so I didn't stand out as much as I did when I came back to the States. I mean, it was just an amazing thing how much drinking went on, in, at least in this air group that I was in. But when I came back and I was on into more standard environment, I continued the drinking pattern that I had started there in Japan, and it just stayed that way. And now I did stand out as a very different drinker from a lot of other people, and I started getting in trouble because of that. I liked microphones. Always liked microphones. You can see I like them now. I liked them. I wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and I just welcomed the chance at a officer's club to get one of these microphones and go up there and do a little routine about the general. You know what I mean? And everybody would laugh and howl, and he'd be back there going, "What's that guy's name up there?" You know, write it down. And a lot of these things came back to haunt me in later years when I was trying to get promoted. So what was happening was my insides were starting to come apart. I was starting to get very frightened because of this alcohol. I was starting to experience the advanced physical symptoms of alcoholism, withdrawal symptoms. I was having them in airplanes. I was losing peripheral vision. I start sweating. My heart would start racing, and this was not conducive to flying. at least from my perspective, it wasn't. It was very intimidating, and it makes me think about how alcoholics have to, I think we experience things that weren't intended for human beings to experience. I mean, all of us has covered one eye through driving because there were two white lines in the, but you don't see that in the driver's manual anywhere, you know, where it says, so you had to figure that out yourself. Because no one ever dreamed that human beings would be experiencing these things. Well, I was having those things in airplanes that the manufacturer never put in the handbook. You know, if this happens, this is the procedure that you follow. And I can remember developing my own operating procedures for what you do when you think you're going to pass out in an airplane. That was, you know, because you're suddenly confronted with it. You just go, you know, I think I'm about to pass out. And so I'll tell you what my answer was. I don't know if it'll ever make it into the flight manual, but my answer was grab the ejection seat with both hands, the curtain, and get a death grip on it. And my theory was that once I passed out, I'd fall forward, and that would fire the seat. I'm out. The plane crashes, but the chute opens automatically. And I float down, and there was sort of that smugness in there, you know, like, I figured out another one, you know, like... they keep throwing these things at me and I keep figuring them out. You know, it's like... Now, some of you non-alcoholics, you may not have ever had any of these things. And I don't know if I've ever mentioned it in a talk out here, but sometimes I mention this, that about 15 years ago, there was six or seven of us sitting around a table, and we were trying to dream up a money-making scheme. Now, this one never went anywhere, but we came up with a game, a Parker Brothers game, for non-alcoholics who would like to know what it's like to be an alcoholic, you know? And so... And this game was called, So You Want to Be an Alcoholic? And, and it's like Monopoly, and you have the dice, and you're, except you go to jail a lot. You go to jail. And you buy high and sell low, you know. On the houses and all of that, and they take credit cards and all this kind of stuff. But the big main event of the game is Take a Chance. You remember those little cards, Take a Chance? And they had some biggies on there, and we came up with some of these, and this is where you really get to experience it. So one card said, you will be blindfolded by these two gentlemen that are coming in and do everything they say. So you get blindfolded and you're taken off and you're in a taxi cab. Next thing you're in an airplane and you find now you're in another cab and you're going around and they get you up in a hotel room. You don't even know what city you're in. And they take all your clothes except your underwear. And they run up a $600 bill on the room in your name. And then they go, okay, you have 18 hours to get from this hotel room to New York City for the most important job interview of your life. And you have $4.75. Yeah. And... you must take these two thumbtacks and punch them into the palm of your hand and never act like they hurt at all the whole time. Ready, get set, go! You're on your way. Now, if that had been an alcoholic, we made the job very easy because we left $4.75, which allows you to get a drink. Which... automatically solves all the rest of the problems because as you know, one drink and you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. And I don't think that would be a big challenge for a practicing alcoholic, right? Out of there, one drink, hustle a suit off of somebody, I'm on the 10-1. Down in the elevator, hey, what city am I in? And you'd be there. So, like you all, I experienced a lot of these breaking new ground situations. And I suppose the one that I found the most overpowering was when the disease finally came to its end, and I was... in a career school, I was trying to attend school. I'm trying to do the best that I can, but I'm drinking around the clock. I'm not flying anymore. And I had a seizure in the classroom, and I was sent off in an ambulance, and I went up into the Bethesda Naval Hospital, and they're studying me for 3 or 4 days, what could cause this seizure. And I went into the DTs and freaked out, and I mean, it was just unbelievable, the hallucinations and all those things. I wrote them down. They were just so terrifying. So I was put in a straitjacket and put back in the nut ward, and I was left there for 6 months, just in that nut ward. And that was a hard situation to deal with. My parents didn't even want to come. They were pretending that it wasn't happening. And how do you explain all these situations? Because everything was going fine. You know, all of a sudden, this person who's doing fine is locked up in a nut wart. How could that happen? You know, well, must be something wrong in the family. All these crazy things that took years to adjust to and explain, and now we're all, you know, laughing over it. But at that point in time, I just had no way of rationalizing or explaining this away anymore. And it was not an alcohol unit. It was just a nut ward. And there wasn't anybody in there who knew anything about alcoholism. And so we just went to group therapy with the other nuts. And once a month, they would talk about alcoholism. And I'll tell you right now, the manic depressives and the schizophrenics and all those people, they don't like alcoholics. They think it's that you shouldn't be there. You don't have a legitimate illness like they do. And so there were three drunks in this place, and we were like the low man on the nut ward, which is just... You know, I hate to keep diverting, but I just remembered one other thing. When I was in that nut ward, I keep looking for this guy. And maybe you're here tonight, you know, because there's a lot of people in this audience. This was 1964, and you were a lieutenant commander in the Navy. And you were not an alcoholic. You were just one of these guys. I don't know what the hell you had. But you and I were big competitors in clay class. And I had made one of the finest ashtrays that had ever been made, and there was going to be a judging that Friday, and you came into my room smoking that big cigar, acting like, you know, it was an accident, and you put it out in the ashtray and knocked it off the thing there and smashed. And I figured a guy like that could end up an alcoholic, and you might end up in AA, and you may be trying to do your ninth step. Now, I've forgotten about the incident totally myself. But just for your sake, I just thought I'd mention that I'm the guy in case you're ever... In that environment, Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. They talked their way into the hospital. They talked to the psychiatrist. They said, you must have some alcoholics. And that's how I heard about AA. A corpsman came into the nut ward after I'd been there about 4 months. And he said, all drunks fall in, right face, in the elevator, and I'm at an AA meeting. And I listened. I wasn't buying into it right then, but shortly after when I got out, and I was an outpatient and going back and forth, and I started drinking again, and I knew I was going to get in serious trouble, I called AA from my house one Sunday, and that was December 7th of 1964, and a huge guy came over to my house who was still my sponsor, and he just came in and took over. And I haven't had a drink since the day he arrived in my life. And I'll tell you a great story. Last August was his 30th anniversary, and I said, I'm going to take you to dinner. And so we went to dinner, and this all took place at the Quantico Marine Base. And we went to dinner in a German restaurant, and that restaurant used to be the house I lived in when he 12-stepped me. And they turned it into a restaurant. And so we're sitting at a table, and the front door that he came through is about 15 feet away from the table. And about halfway through the dinner, he turned to me and he said, you know, we've come a long way from that door to this table. And I went, yeah, we have. Wow. And I guess that's what I'd like to talk about for the rest of the time is how far it is from that door to that table. You know, it doesn't look like it's very far. It doesn't look like it's very far from the day I came in to today. And in a sense, it's not very far. It's very fresh in my mind when I see new people in AA. I can remember that. It's sort of there. But on the other hand, it's light years away from the person that arrived here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you did, and what we do to everybody, I guess, who comes to AA, we fool them. Did you ever think about that, how we really fool all the new people that come in here? We let them think that AA is about not drinking. Just come here and don't drink. And everything will be all right. And then way down in the fine print, where you can't see it, it says all you have to do is not drink and change everything there is about you. And everything will be all right. And I remember keep telling my sponsor, I said, I didn't come here to change everything there is about me. You remember how that, you know, at first you start out and then come in here and they go, okay, just don't drink, go to me. Just don't drink, go to me. That's the deal. That's okay, I'll do that. What a sacrifice. I'm going to not drink. And I feel like I have just done the most huge thing that's ever, you know. And so a few months go by and my sponsor says, you know, I just think you probably ought to stop that embezzling down with the slush fund money, you know, at the club. I said, I thought this was Alcoholics Anonymous. Is this Embezzlers Anonymous or, you know? Well, it's just we find that it's real hard for people to stay sober if they keep screwing around with money. Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll make a big sacrifice and no drinking, no embezzling. Then he comes up and another month goes by and he's, you know, it's our experience. Whenever he started sentences with, it's our experience, you knew something else was coming up. And he said, you know, we really find if you're going to have good sobriety, you just can't keep having these affairs. And you know, what are you going to screw with everything here? I mean, you know, just, I thought we just came in here to not drink. No, no, you just, all right, I'll try that. And every month he had a get rid of something for the month club. You know what I mean? It was just, he had another idea of something that ought to go. And a lot of years have gone by and he's made a lot of suggestions over the years and they all have had to do with stopping doing something. So I'm going to tell you, if you're new, this spiritual program is so filled with paradoxes, you're not going to believe it. When we come in here and we talk about growing spiritually and character building, it's not done by getting anything. It's done by getting rid of things. So in order to get all the things that are here, you do that by getting rid of things. It's the whole business of sobriety, is getting rid of things. Isn't that interesting? I think the spiritual journey is like a balloon ride. If you want a better view, you throw something else overboard. And then you go up higher. And I've never been a balloon rider, but I know about spirituality. And as soon as you make the effort to go up higher to get a better view, you can't stay there. Because if you stay there over an extended period of time, that view won't be good anymore. And you'll get bored with it. It used to be exciting, but it won't last. So you've got to get rid of something else. And then you go up a little bit further, and the view is wonderful. And you go, isn't that wonderful? I'm there. But we're not there. We're just there for today. And that's not going to last. And sobriety consists, as Chuck Chamberlain talks about in his book, of an endless series of finding something else to throw overboard. I mean, that, in my judgment, is all that sobriety is and all this spiritual path is an endless series of inventories to find one more thing to throw overboard so that the view is better. It may not be the view is better. It may be that the signal is better. Sometimes I think of spirituality as the ability to be in touch with a power that communicates directly to you that all is well. Now that may sound impossible. You're going to be able to get in touch with something that by the mere touch of this power will assure you that all is well. I remember when I was little, maybe 4 years old, and you'd go wandering over three houses away into a neighbor's yard, and a big dog would jump out from behind a bush and go, "Row!" And man, you would think you're going to die, and you run home, and this is the end of the world, and then you find your mother, and your mother comes out, and she puts your hand on your head, and she goes, "It's all right." And you go, "Oh, it is? Good. Well, I'll go back to playing baseball." And I'm... You remember that? The wonderful power of her hand and just go, "It's all right." Well, if she says it's all right, it must be it's all right. And that, to me, is my relationship with the higher power. It's this wonderful power to tell me that everything's all right, but I can't hear that power. I can't hear that voice that says everything's all right over the racket of a resentment. And I can't hear it over the tremendous static of panic and fear. And I can't hear it over the roar of anger. And so I have to learn how to get quiet. And I think that's what our steps are all about, is the ability to quiet my ego and to quiet my negative thinking so that this signal that's been there all along, I firmly believe, as Bill said, the fundamental idea was born inside of us, the fundamental idea of a God, just like the fundamental idea of a friend. Now, the question is, when we arrive here, we all have different ideas about a higher power. I certainly did, and I didn't want to believe in one. I was a higher power myself, and there's a big process that's involved in becoming spiritual, and it's called changing your mind. There's a wonderful chapter of the agnostic in the big book, and I remember seeing that chapter early on, and I didn't read it, but I knew what was in it, because some of us know without reading things what's in there, just a gift that we have. And I knew that chapter was how agnostics stay sober in AA, as opposed to how the rest of the people do it. But later on when I read it, that's not what it's about at all. And if you're new, I can tell you what that chapter says in three words. It says, change your mind. That's what the chapter of the agnostic said. Become a former agnostic is the best advice. And so the whole point, at least to me, of our program is to put me in touch, to have conscious contact with something that will tell me that everything is all right. Now, in order to believe this, it's a leap of faith because I can't see it. If you're new, you can read the steps until your eyes are blue and they will never make sense. This is not an intellectual program. So you can study it for all you want, and when you get through, nothing will happen. You'll just know how to quote things. But nothing will happen because you won't be able to understand or see anything in the steps until you do them. Then they become visible. The spiritual life becomes visible only through action. And that's what this program is. It is action. Once we do the action, then it becomes very apparent, all the results. And it comes into our lives. So we have to take it on faith from the other people in the program that this really is true. That there really is a higher power that will signal internally to you that all is well. And I remember having a tremendous credibility problem with that. the proposition that there is a power that's going to signal to me that all is well. And I got thinking about when I was a little kid, I was 12 years old, and I was in the Boy Scouts, and the scoutmaster said, today's lesson is on the compass. I want to tell you all about the compass, because if you ever get lost in the woods, and your life depends on it, this is life or death we're talking about. If your life depends on it, we have something that's like my little watch here. He said, this will save your life. It's called a compass. Now, the way this works, there's a big rock up at the North Pole. And there's a needle in here, and this needle always points to the big rock at the North Pole. Now, I didn't sit out there and go, big rock at the North Pole. You want me to buy a story like that? Big rock at the North Pole? I'm going to put my life on the line. You know, I want to go up and see it. I just said, that's good. I like one of those. I'll put it in my pocket. If I ever get where my life is on the line, I'll be glad to pull that compass out and totally trust that this thing is pointing to a big rock at the North Pole. I bought that. I didn't have any problem buying that. And then later on, when I got in flight school and we got through flying in VFR, they said, now we're going to show you how to come in between these two mountains when it's terribly bad weather. And if you miss, you fly right into the mountain and the runway is down in between these two big mountains and you can't see it. Not to worry. There's this invisible radio beam that comes up from that runway right to your airplane. I don't remember saying, invisible radio beam is coming up. You want me to buy into that? Then I'm going to fly this thing down. The thing's going beep, 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 beep. And at the last second, boom, there's the runway. And if it's not there, I'm dead. I just went, where's the radio beam? Let me have that. I can hardly wait to go do that. So then I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they go, you know, if you follow these steps, you can get in touch with the power of the universe that will guide you through the rest of your life. And I went, power the universe. Give me a break. Power of the universe. This is, and let me just take the last few minutes. This is what I think is the great struggle that goes on for all of our sobriety between our intellectual side and our spiritual side, because we are spiritual people and we're intellectual people. We have our minds and our instinctual drives, and they have a tremendous force. Bill talks about instincts balk at investigation. You ever read that in the 12 and 12? And there's going to be a rebellion when you go in there and try and take control of your life away from the instinctual and the intellectual and turn it over to a higher power. And this rebellion just sort of goes on, and it causes me, and I suppose all human beings, to somehow try to find a middle ground between my intellect and God. And you really see that in the sixth step, where we're talking about getting rid of all character defects, turn our life over to the care of a higher power, because then I could get rid of all character defects. And what a wonderful thing that would be. That's the way I think about it at first. In other words, what if I were to say to all of you tonight, how would you all like to become in 1 hour Mother Teresa? Just think what that would be, that be at that high level of spiritual development. There wouldn't be too many hands going up. Why? She ain't driving around in a Cadillac, right? She's got no credit card, no bank account. I mean, she doesn't have fun. I mean, she's out there helping other people all the time. And so I think that's very noble, and it's something I ought to move towards gradually. Move towards. I'm not ruling it out, but I don't want to rush there. I'd like to be sort of known as a person who's like Mother Teresa without going overboard, totally into this. So when we talk about getting rid of the character defects, we talk about, we rationalize and say to ourselves, I want to get rid of some of that. You know what I mean? So when we talk about greed, what do you want to do about greed? Well, you know, I'd like to not be so greedy. That's about what I'd like to do. I don't want to totally get rid of greed, because I might need some of that just to keep some stuff for myself. I mean, you know, what if this God stuff isn't true? You got to watch out for yourself. And Bill keeps throwing it, half measures avail us nothing. So you keep wondering, when you shoot for these halfway goals, that wonderful thing in the 12 and 12, we try for as much perfection as will get us by. Isn't that a wonderful thing, you know, that how far would you like to go in the program? Well, I'd like to do a little better than I'm doing now and all these things. It's because we enjoy our character defects. We love being angry and superior to other people. What would it be like to have no lust? I'd like to get rid of most of it, but don't you think you ought to keep some? So we draw a line there, and we draw a line here, and we draw a line there, and we become our own sentencer of no progress. And the view stays the same. And as the view stays the same, we get depressed, and we get unhappy. And this is where the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous comes in. Left to our own devices, God knows what we'd do. But you and I need each other desperately in this struggle between our spirituality and our intellect. That's what meetings are all about. It's to remind you and I what the answer is. What the answer is. We need to be reminded every single day in order to go against that part of ourselves that would take over again. And so we're so lucky to have each other and to have sponsors and to have home groups and to have the ability to honestly talk to one another so that I give you permission to come up to me and say, what's wrong? Stick your nose in my business and force it out of me. Force me to say I got a resentment. Force me to say what it is that's holding me back. We don't like to get rid of unresolved conflict. I'll close with this and see if you relate to this. Our intellect wants to figure things out so that when someone does something to us, we have to resolve it. Now, if you're new, this program, a spiritual thing, doesn't work like the intellectual process does. In the spiritual solution, we get things removed. They just get lifted out like your alcoholism was. You don't have to figure out why you're an alcoholic. You don't have to know anything about that. You just follow these steps and your alcohol problem will be lifted away and it'll stay there as long as you maintain a day at a time your spiritual condition. You will never be troubled by alcohol. It's just lifted away because you became entirely ready to have it be lifted away. But what about somebody double-crosses you at work? What about somebody rips you off in a relationship and goes off with somebody else? And you are hurt, and you've got this resentment, and you've got this thing that's like a red-hot coal in your hand. And someone from the program comes up and said, would you like to have that coal lifted out so that it no longer bothers you, and you'll no longer be in pain? And you say, I'm not letting go of this coal till I find out who put it here. I'm not through figuring out the revenge. I'm not through figuring this thing out. And no, I don't want it lifted out of here. And our higher power stands there, totally ready to lift away anything that we would be willing to get rid of. And I think we need each other desperately to remind and to take us back to the solution. Because the solution really is one answer for all problems. One answer, getting closer to your higher power. As soon as you get close enough, all will be well. And if you're new, I hope you get there soon. Thank you.